Yes, welcome to week four of this exploration. So far we've been looking at the weirdness of quantum physics and trying to draw some parallels with the Dharma. And physics, quantum physics, is particularly concerned with the fundamentals of matter. Yeah? And last week we saw some of that weirdness in... Well, what did we do last week? Can any of you remember? Say that again. The cat in the box. Schrodinger's cat. We saw Schrodinger's cat. And what was the point of the cat in the box, apart from humiliating me in my drawing skills? Sorry?
Was it dead or wasn't it dead?
And according to the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics, it's both dead and not dead until you look, until somebody, a conscious observer, looks, and that act of observation somehow collapses the two possibilities into an actuality. And until that act of observation, all there exists is possibilities, or probabilities as they're called. And both probabilities exist equally, a live cat and a dead cat. And so quantum physics, at least this interpretation of quantum physics, the Copenhagen interpretation, is questioning the notion of an objectively existing material world out there, independent of subjects observing that material world. Yeah, that's the implication. There are other interpretations of quantum physics, and we looked at the many worlds. Well, we talked briefly, didn't we, about the many worlds interpretation, which says the cat is alive in one universe and dead in another universe. And as soon as you set up the experiment, the universe split into those two parallel universes, because both probabilities, both possibilities exist, but they cause the universe to split, to branch into different universes. So there are these parallel universes going on all the time, infinite number of them. Yeah. I went to see a film. Has anybody seen Source Code? Source Code is it's quite a good film for if you just want a cheap... No, I was going to say cheap night out, I don't mean that. If you want a relatively lightweight night out, it's a good film, isn't it? Anyway, it's playing around with this notion of parallel universes. They don't actually explain how or anything like that. They just sort of wave their arms and say the word quantum, and the universe seems to split. But it's quite exciting. Anyway, I've distracted myself. That was a many worlds, though.
To discredit your idea of
Schrodinger invented this experiment in his mind. It's a thought experiment, a Gedanken experiment, to show the absurdity of the Copenhagen interpretation. But the Copenhagen interpretation somehow survived that thought experiment and still became the standard, most popular interpretation until relatively recently, when other interpretations have perhaps become more popular. And as I say, most physicists don't worry about the interpretations anymore. They say, look, it works. Every time you conduct an experiment, you get the right answers from quantum physics. And so quantum physics is somehow working, and let's not worry too much about what it means about reality. That's what most physicists kind of have settled on. Yeah. There was another interpretation that we touched on, though, which was David Bohm's interpretation, which is a sort of hidden variables. It's a group of interpretations called the hidden variable theories. His is a particular type of hidden variable theory, and in his interpretation, somehow, what's going on is one whole reality, one totality of order that somehow unfolds every moment, and in that unfolding we experience things as separate. We experience different objects, we experience ourselves as a subject, but somehow all of that separateness is illusory. There's an underlying wholeness to reality that's unfolding and explicating itself all the time. And nothing is separate. And then we saw another experiment where it was spooky action at a distance. It was these two particles that were separated in space behaving as one particle. Do you remember that? I talked about them as twins. And that's an experiment that's been done in the labs now since 1980-something. And again, what it does is it confirms that quantum mechanics, quantum physics, is somehow still working. It confirms that it's accurate and predicting the right results. But what this experiment shows is that if quantum mechanics is true, if quantum physics is true, then it's no longer possible to say that these two particles are separate. Even though they're separate in space, or they look separate, it's no longer possible to say that they're separate. Now again, that has profound sort of interpretive consequences. If you can't say that two things are separate when they're separated in space, then what does that mean for anything that's separate? Do you see what I mean? This notion of separateness at all. Again, people don't know what that means, apart from there's something more weird going on than meets the eye. Yeah. So all of that was last week. Oh, and lastly, we looked at Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared. And can anybody remember what we were saying about that? What does it mean?
Matter is energy.
Matter is energy, and energy is matter. So matter and energy aren't separate things anymore, and particles of matter can pop up out of where there was no matter, sort of seemingly out of nothing, if there's energy there. And similarly, they can disappear again and release energy as a flash of light or as heat. And an example, a catastrophic example of that is the atomic bomb, where matter becomes energy. Yeah? And a tiny bit of matter is equivalent to a huge amount of energy. That's what that equation is telling us. So that's why the atomic bomb was so horrendously powerful. You only need a small lump of matter to release an incredible amount of energy. We haven't yet been able to harness that energy in a useful way. But in a way, that's how our sun shines. It's converting matter into energy all the time. It's having a sort of fusion reaction inside itself and releasing all this energy. Billions of tons of hydrogen are being converted into helium, and all this energy has been released in the sun, and that's how stars shine. So again, quantum physics says things about tiny little bits of matter, but those tiny little bits of matter make up everything. So without quantum physics, we wouldn't have a theory of why the sun shines. We wouldn't have a theory of why lasers shine. We wouldn't have a theory, really, of electricity conducting in metals. We wouldn't have a theory that allows what are called semiconductors, which are the basis of silicon chips. We wouldn't have any of that without the theory of quantum physics. So it underlies a lot of both technology and understanding of how the world works. Okay. So far that's matter. This week I want to focus on the stage on which matter plays itself out, which is the stage of space and time. Yeah. So, as well as matter and energy, we experience, or we have a notion of, space and time, don't we? But it's not obvious what space and time are. Even when we say to ourselves, what do we mean by space? and time, it's not sort of very clear what we do mean. What is it? Is space a thing? Or is it just the arena in which things are? And what is time? Is time a thing? Is it like a flowing thing? When you actually start to ask yourself these questions, it's not obvious what these so-called things, entities are, space and time. Yeah. So that's what I want to explore a little bit this week. And I want to explore it from the perspective of physics, and I want to try and bring in a Dharmic perspective on what space and time are. So are you with me so far? Yeah. So until early part of the 20th century, when Newton had, in a way, started this whole game of physics rolling, he had assumed that space and time were somehow like an empty stage on which things and events happened. Yeah? So there's this arena of three-dimensional space, yeah? And time somehow flowing through that three-dimensional space, and then the universe and everything else happens within it, inside it. That sort of makes sense, doesn't it? Three-dimensional space and a sort of flowing current of time. And he didn't really think any more about it or say more about it. So he developed laws of motion, of matter, moving through that arena, saying, well, this is how matter moves through this stage of space and time. So one of his assumptions was that space and time are absolute sort of arenas. They themselves don't change. So it's not like you get space changing. Space is the stage on which things change. Yeah? And time itself just flows from past, present to future. And it flows equally, at an equal rate for everything in the universe. So for everything in the universe, the past is always in the past, the present is now, whatever that means, and the future's yet to happen. And it's an equal pace of flow of time, equal rate of flow of time everywhere, throughout space and for everyone. So that sort of makes sense, doesn't it? So I know that, you know, if you go to I don't know, Australia, it's possibly yesterday or tomorrow or whatever. But in a way, that's just to do with the rotation of the Earth and how we mark days days and nights. But in an absolute sense, Newton's time was the same everywhere. Yeah? Does that make sense? I don't know if that makes... It's sort of our common sense assumptions of space and time. Yeah? So Einstein came along, this young 20-something, 26-year-old, I think he was, in 1905, working as a clerk in this patent office, and in his spare time, thinking about fundamental ideas around physics. And yes, in that 1 year in 1905, he managed to write and publish three groundbreaking, sort of earth-shattering papers that turned the notion of our universe upside down. One of those papers was his special theory of relativity. Only one of these three papers in 1905, and it was only a part-time occupation because he had a day job. Although I think he managed to sort of, he was probably not he was working on the job, probably. So, but Yes, he's published his special theory of relativity. And I'm going to just try and explain some of the implications of his special theory of relativity, or try and explain some of the ideas behind it, and what it means for space and time. And later on, he worked on those ideas even more, and some years later published his general theory of relativity. So there are two theories of relativity, and we're going to touch on that as well. Okay. So one of the things that Einstein imagined was a beam of light travelling as it does at the speed of light. The speed of light is something like, can anybody remember? Kilometres per second. 300,000 kilometres per second. So physicists had discovered that through measurement, but also the equations had shown that there was this speed of light. It wasn't obvious what happened. Well, out of some equations, what had happened was that the speed of light had dropped out of these equations, had emerged from these equations. But anything that moves, it doesn't move at an absolute speed. It moves relative to you, doesn't it? So what I mean is, if you're driving along the road at 30 miles an hour, and there's a car coming the other way, on the other side of the road, at 30 miles an hour, then you'll experience that car coming at 60 miles an hour. Do you see what I mean? Towards you. You'll experience the approach at 60 miles an hour. Does that make sense? Yeah? Similarly, if you were moving in opposite directions, a car was moving away at 30 miles an hour, and in the opposite direction another car was moving away at 30 miles an hour, then their distance would be increasing at 60 miles an hour. And any observer in one of those cars would think, oh yes, the other car's moving away at 60 miles an hour. Yeah? That's how sort of objects are experienced as moving. So Einstein tried to imagine, what it would be like if he was chasing after a beam of light moving at 300,000 kilometres per second. So again, it was a thought experiment, a Gedanken experiment. He imagined this beam of light moving at 300,000 kilometres per second. You know, maybe light emitted by the sun moving towards the Earth. And he imagined that he was travelling next to it, also at 300,000 kilometres per second. Yeah? So when he looked at that beam of light, what would he see? How fast was that light going to appear to be moving to him if he was moving at the same speed?
Alongside it.
So it wouldn't appear to be moving. Does everybody see that? If he's moving alongside this beam of light, to him, if he's moving at exactly the same speed alongside it, it wouldn't appear to be moving. Yeah? It would be almost like the light was stationary and he could reach out and just grab a bit of light. Yeah? But in practice, light never appears to be stationary. Yeah? Light never appears to be stationary. It seems contradictory to say that light is stationary. So he was wondering, what's going on then? And his answer to it was that the speed of light is always 300,000 kilometres per second, no matter how fast you're moving, and whether you're moving towards it, or away from it, or alongside it. It will always be measured by you as moving at the speed of light, 300,000 kilometres per second. Yeah? So, in his thought experiment, the answer would be that even if he was moving at 300,000 kilometres per second, next to this beam of light, the beam of light to him would still shoot off in front of him at 300,000 kilometres per second. Which is weird, isn't it? It's very, very strange. Or, take another example. This beam of light is coming down from the sun, and he's moving towards it at 300,000 kilometres a second, at the speed of light as well. You'd expect him to think that they were closing in on each other at 600,000 kilometres per second, wouldn't you? You'd expect him to think that the light was moving towards him at 600,000 kilometres per second. But in fact, when you measure it, you always get 300,000 kilometres per second, no matter how fast you're moving. Towards it, away from it, alongside it. Really weird. Because nothing else in our experience behaves like light. Everything else behaves like the cars on the motorway. Yeah? You can add speeds up, they're relative speeds. Light has an absolute velocity, absolute speed. And that's really, really weird. Really weird. And out of that come all sorts of other weirdnesses. So you have to say, what's going on? What's going on if a beam of light's racing towards me and I'm racing towards it, but somehow it's racing towards me at the same speed as if I was standing still? Yeah? And the fact that I'm racing towards it makes no difference to how fast I'll measure it moving towards me, if I could measure it. So, are you with me so far? Do you understand the problem, the paradox, the weirdness? Yeah? That light is moving at the same speed, regardless of the observer or the source. I mean, that's another example. So, the source... sorry, I'll come back to you in a second, Manny. If you had... the light source is, I don't know, a beacon on a police car, and the police car's moving really, really fast, you might expect the light source for a stationary person to be moving even faster than the speed of light. Do you see what I mean? Because you've got this fast-moving car emitting a beam of light, and so the beam of light might be moving even faster if you were standing still. But no, when you measure it, regardless of how fast the car is moving, the beam of light that you measure will always be moving at the same speed, 300,000 kilometres per second. It's as if light doesn't, well, behave like any other thing. Yeah? It just doesn't behave like anything else. Manny, yeah?
You know, I was just a bit confused about that. What happens if you stick in an observer? Say if I'm sitting here and Einstein comes racing past me by 300,000 kilometres per second.
Yeah.
surely the light relative to me is then going at twice that speed.
Yeah. Well, that's even, it's even weirder.
Yeah.
So if Einstein's racing past you at 300,000 kilometres per second, chasing a beam of light, and you're standing or sitting there still, as it were, both of you will measure that speed of light as 300,000 kilometres per second. Einstein, who's chasing it, will still feel that it's moving away from him at 300,000 kilometres per second. And you, if you measure it, even though you're standing still, will still measure that it's moving away from you at 300,000 kilometres per second.
But would I then see Einstein moving as fast as the light?
You'd see Einstein racing ahead of you,
yeah,
at whatever speed you measure him. Yes, you would. And but you'll see the light also moving.
So, for instance, you know, like the sun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's pull that away or
yeah, yeah,
distance, yeah.
Yeah.
How could you actually measure it to know that far? And
So we can measure how far away the sun is, and that's an interesting point because the sun's the source of all the light that we have, the natural light that we have, and the sun's around 93 million miles away. Don't ask me how they know that; they do. And light takes time to travel from the sun to the earth, because light is always moving at 300,000 kilometres per second. And it takes roughly 8 minutes to reach from the sun to us. So if the sun were to suddenly disappear, we wouldn't know it for 8 minutes. We'd still see it in the sky for 8 minutes. And so when you look at the sun, you're not seeing...
But we still see it.
Yeah. So when you see the sun, when you look at the sun, you're not seeing it as it is now. You're seeing it as it was 8 minutes ago. Yeah. But that's another slightly different point, and I'm going to come on to that later. But hold that in mind, perhaps. Yeah.
We keep talking about looking at things.
Yeah.
If the speed of light wasn't absolute, then when you looked at things, they'd look weird anyway.
They might look weird anyway, that's right.
If you were travelling at the speed of light,
that's right.
Clock,
that's right. It would all look...
If you were travelling towards it at the speed
that's
of light,
right.
Then it would move at clock speed.
So somehow there's something going to be weird anyway, isn't there? Just about the notion
because
of...
Because light's in the perceiving.
Yeah. Don't ask me what it would look like if the speed of light wasn't constant. I don't know, actually. But what happens is that the speed of light is constant. Yeah? The speed of light is constant. So the way that this is explained is really, really weird. So I'm going to try and take it slowly. I'm not sure I don't intuitively understand it myself, so I can tell you what's said. So first of all, when we measure something's speed, what we're doing is measuring how fast it goes in a given time, how far it goes in a given time. So when you say a car is moving at 30 miles an hour, what you're saying is that if you let it go for an hour, it would cover 30 miles. Yeah? So 300,000 kilometres a second is a speed of light that's saying in 1 second it covers this distance. So speed is talking about the distance covered in a bit of time. Yeah? In a second or an hour or whatever. Miles or metres or kilometres covered in a bit of time. So Einstein's moving at very, very fast, and he's chasing this beam of light. But the light to him still seems to be moving away from him at 300,000 kilometres an hour. What's happening? A second, sorry. What's happening? And the explanation that Einstein came up with is that for him, he'll measure it as 300,000 kilometres per second, even though he's moving really fast in line with it, chasing it, because for him, time slows down. So his watch will be running slower than our watches, stationary here in the shrine room, if he was leaping past us. Time for him would actually slow down. So when he measured how far the light had moved per second, for him, a second would be slower than our second. Time would slow down for him. And the answer that he'd get from the measurement, it would slow down exactly right, so that the answer he got from measuring a speed would be that the speed of light is still 300,000 kilometres per second. So for him, time would be slowing down. So his conclusion was that anything, any observer that is moving at a constant rate, for that observer, time runs more slowly than if that observer was stationary. Yeah? Time actually runs more slowly. So then, time after 1905 was no longer this thing that ran at the same rate for everybody in the universe. Yeah? So the number 8 bus might be going past now, down Roman Road, and according to the specialist theory of relativity, for the people on that number 8 bus, time is moving a little bit more slowly than it is for us. A tiny little bit more slowly than it is for us. So their watches are slower, their heartbeat is slower, their aging process is slower, every measurement of time that you can imagine is slower for them, because they're moving relative to us. Yeah? They're moving relative to us.
Is that relative to the Earth?
Let's just say relative to us. relative to us. So it's running slower than it would be for us, because we're static, we're stationary. Well, exactly. So it gets weirder. So just hold this, that for us, when we look at their rate of time, it would be that they were running, their rate of time was running slower. But you're right. You could say, if the number 8 bus is passing us at 20 miles an hour, to them, they would look like they're still sitting still on the bus. Yeah? And it would look like the rest of Roman Road is moving past them, including us, at 20 miles an hour in the opposite direction. You get this on trains, don't you? That's how it appears. So all motion is relative. So from a passenger on the number 8 bus's perspective, she's sitting still, we're doing the moving. So from her perspective, if this theory is right, our watches are running slower than hers. Yeah? Because we're doing the moving. So she would see it as if we're aging less rapidly, running more slowly. And we would see it as if her watch was running more slowly. Really weird. Yeah? And you say, well, which one's right? Is her time more slow than ours? Or is our time more slow than hers? And Einstein says, well, they're both true. Depends where you are and how fast you're moving. Yeah, so for her, that's her rate of time. For us, this is our rate of time. Now, we must break for tea. Okay, very good. So, so far, we've just started to touch on the weirdness of relativity. There's more to say, but the point that I want to try and underline so far is that time slows down for moving objects. It's no longer a fixed rate of flow for everybody and everything in the universe. Time flows at different rates depending on whether the object or the observer is moving through space, yeah, and how fast they're moving. Now, one correction that I should make is that Einstein, in his thought experiment, was trying to move at the speed of light to keep track of this beam of light. And actually, another thing that comes out of relativity, his own theory of relativity, is that nothing apart from light can move as fast as light. That the speed of light is an absolute ceiling on how fast anything can move. Yeah? So actually Einstein wouldn't have been able to move at the speed of light, because nothing can. You can never get to it. You can get close to it, but you can never get to it. Yeah, Roger.
That's slightly inaccurate, because actually if you were travelling faster than the speed of light, then you would still be able to do that. But you'll be going backwards in time.
That's a theory, but you could never get to that speed. There's no way of knowing how you'd ever get to travel faster than the speed of light. But hold that theory, because I don't want to, in a way, go in backwards time just yet. I just want to, in a way, get to the point where we have a sense that time is relative depending on the observer, or depending on actually the whatever it is that's moving. Yeah. And that's weird enough, but when you start to look at the implications of that, it somehow gets even weirder. So one of the implications of this is around what do we mean by the concept of now? What do we mean by now? When you think about this moment now, I mean, the concept of now, it's quite elusive, isn't it? Because it's always moving, this now. But if we were to think about now, perhaps what we'd say is that now could be defined by everything that happens at this instant. Everything that happened in the whole universe at this instant. So this instant now, you were sitting here, I'm sitting here, the number 8 bus was somewhere down the road, the sun was on the other side, or the earth was facing, the sun was facing the other side of the earth. All of those things were happening now. Do you see what I mean? Somewhere someone's going out for a meal, somebody's watching a film, right at this instant. And all of those events in this instant could be defined by, could help to define what we mean by this instant. Yeah? Does that make sense so far? But in Einstein's theory of relativity, what two people mean by now changes depending on how fast they're moving relative to each other. So one person's now will actually be somebody else's then. Yeah? Which is really, really weird. So I'm going to try and explain this with one of my masterclass drawings. But this time I cheated and prepared earlier, so prepare to be amazed. There we go. Can you see that? That's worthy of preserving. Is that a bit too small for those of you at the back? You might just need to come forward. See if you can come forward, because I'm not going to be able to bring the flip chart forward. I can turn it around a bit. Does that? I'll explain it, and that might make it a bit clearer. What you've got here is a train moving in this direction, and that's a train carriage, if that wasn't already obvious, which I'm sure it was. That's a train carriage. That's another bit of a train carriage. That's another bit of a train carriage. Yeah? And this is a platform. And on the platform, you've got Sue watching this passing train carriage. And she can see through the windows of this carriage as it passes through. On the actual carriage, you've got Alice and Bob. Yeah? And Alice and Bob are standing at either end of this train carriage. And they're going to conduct a sort of experiment. Well, it's not really an experiment. What they're trying to do is that each of them has got a stop clock or a watch. No, let's call it a watch. Each has got some sort of watch or a clock. And what they're trying to do is synchronize their clocks, yeah, with each other. And the way that it's going to happen is that there's right in the middle of the carriage, equidistant from each of them, there's this flashing bulb, a device that's going to flash. And when it flashes, light will go off in all directions, and there'll be a beam of light that goes to Bob, and a beam of light that goes to Alice. And as soon as the beam of light hits their eye, i.e. as soon as they see it, they're going to set their clock to noon. Yeah? So, does that make sense so far? I'm going to draw in the beams of light. So this is the actual experiment happening now, as I draw it. The bulb flashes, and you get this beam of light. Oh, going to Bob. And this beam of light going to Alice. And because the bulb is exactly halfway between Bob and Alice, the beam of light should take the same length of time to reach Bob and reach Alice. Yeah? So they figure that they should be able to set their clocks to noon, and then when they compare their clocks, sure enough, their clocks are synchronized. They're running from noon, yeah? But Sue is watching all this happen from the platform. And what she sees is this whole train carriage moving in this direction quite fast, yeah? Really quite fast. And what she sees is that because this train carriage is moving in this direction,
she sees that Alice is actually moving towards the light bulb when it flashed. She's moving towards this light, this beam of light. And Bob is actually moving away from the beam of light. Yeah? So from Sue's perspective, Alice is going to see the beam. The beam's going to hit Alice before it hits Bob. Yeah? Because light travels at the same speed. So Sue sees that Alice is moving towards it, and she'll hit it first, as it were. And Bob is moving away from it, and it will take longer. And so what Sue sees happening is that she sees Alice set her clock to noon a couple of seconds before she sees Bob set his clock to noon. Yeah? So she sees this disparity between when this event happened. If you asked Alice and Bob, they'd say they both saw the beam of light at the same time, and their clocks prove it. If you say to Sue what happened, she says, no, Alice saw the beam of light before Bob did, and she set her clock before Bob did. Yeah? So Sue's idea of what happens at a particular instant is different to Alice and Bob's idea of what's happening at that particular instant. Sue's idea of now, at one instant, she'd just see Alice setting her clock, but not Bob, and then Bob setting it a couple of instants later. But according to Alice, Bob set the thing at the same time she did. That's weird, isn't it? That's really weird. So again, Einstein said, who's right? Both, well, all three of them are. All three of them are. And what we've got to let go of is a sense that now means the same thing for all observers. Now doesn't mean the same thing. If you define now by what's happening, then what's happening now for me might not be happening now for the person on the number 8 bus. It'll happen in the past, or it'll happen a bit later. That's really weird, isn't it? That's really weird.
Sorry, what happens when Alice and Bob get off the train and show their clocks to the girl?
Well, according to Alice and Bob, their clocks will still be synchronised, won't it? So they'll still see that it's synchronised. But to get off the train, they've got to actually slow down, haven't they? And stop, indeed, stop. And that act of slowing down will bring their clocks in line with Sue. So somehow, it'll all sort of work out. But from Sue's perspective, Alice's clock will still have been set before Bob's.
I'm a little bit confused. Didn't you say that regardless of what direction you're travelling in and how fast, that it's still 300,000 kilometres?
Yeah, yeah, it is. It is.
So isn't it just an optical illusion for Sue that Alice sees it first, because everyone sees it at the same time?
So the light's still moving towards Alice at 300. She'd still measure it at 300,000 kilometres per second. But for Sue, from her perspective, it's got less far to go. It's got less far to go because Alice has already moved to it.
Because the train's
moving. Yeah. So the bulb went off and then the train moves, so Alice moved towards them. Do you see what I mean? So it's got less far to go. So it takes less time. Really, really weird. So both people, Alice, Sue and Bob, all three people, are right in their frame of reference. So what you've got in relativity and special relativity is a shifting sense, a shifting notion of time. Time is no longer an absolute flow that flows through the universe from past to present to future at the same rate.
Instead, what you've got is that time shifts for each observer depending on how fast they're moving in space relative to another observer. It's all completely relative. Yeah? If you, and the faster you move, the slower time becomes for you relative to somebody who wasn't moving. And they've sort of proved this in the lab. They've got these particles, for example, called muons, and muons only live a fraction of a fraction of a second. But muons also appear in cosmic rays from outer space and travel down to Earth. And if they were at rest, they would only live a tiny fraction of a second and never have time to reach Earth. But they're moving very, very fast, quite close to the speed of light. And so they live longer, because they're moving fast, because for them time has slowed down, and so they manage to reach Earth. Now the reason that we don't see all these paradoxes in everyday life on Earth is because for this sort of thing to make an appreciable difference, you've got to be moving really fast. You've got to be moving at a speed that's pretty close to the speed of light before you start to notice the difference in the clocks and in the times. So for the number 8 bus, you know, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen in a way that's noticeable. Yeah?
Was this about the same time that Salvador Dali started
making those droopy clocks? I don't know. Surrealism, when was that? When was that? Does anybody know? Yeah, 20s and 30s. So later. But maybe he was influenced. I don't know. But yes, it's because we don't in everyday speeds we don't come anywhere close to 300,000 kilometers per second that we don't notice this sort of thing happening. But what they have done is they've taken some really accurate atomic clocks made from cesium atoms, and I think this was done in the 1970s. They put these really accurate, well, one really accurate clock and was put on a plane. The other really accurate clock was synchronized with it but kept on the ground. And the one on the plane was put on a jumbo jet, a Pan Am flight, and sent traveling. And when it came back, it was a fraction of a fraction of a fraction slower. It had lost a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of time compared to the one that had remained on the ground, because it travelled fast. Yeah? So time really was, clocks did run slow. That's strange, yeah? So I just want to just come to a Dharmic perspective. From a Dharmic perspective, both space and time are the sort of way that we structure our experience. But from a Buddhist perspective, they're not seen as absolute realities. They're not seen as something definitely out there, independent of our experience of them. They're somehow part of our conscious construction of the world. The way that we experience anything is already happening in space and time, but space and time are part of what allows that experience to happen. They're not necessarily out there. It's almost as if consciousness plays a role in them. So when you meditate, sometimes your sense of time changes, doesn't it? It changes. I mean, I'm not saying that this is the same as what Einstein's saying in terms of Alice and Bob and moving really fast. All I'm saying is that Buddhism has a notion that time, sort of, the experience of time, is somehow subjective. It's not just out there. Yeah. Sometimes, for us, it appears as if a 40-minute meditation feels like an eternity. And sometimes, it's as if it goes really, really quickly. On retreat, time does funny things, doesn't it? After 3 or 4 days on retreat, you can feel like you've been there a long, long time, and yet the days on retreat can go really rapidly. So there's a subjective experience of time that Buddhism's always been quite happy with. And Buddhism hasn't tried to say, look, time is definitely an objective thing out there. So I think that's worth sort of bearing in mind. It's different to what Einstein's saying, but there's a parallel. Yeah.
But even that common parlance, everybody talks about time slow up.
Yeah.
Today's really dragged, or
yeah,
or this week.
Yeah, really, yeah, that's right. That's right. So that is our experience, our common sense experience. You know, when you're clock watching at work, it never seems to move, does it? And, it just takes longer. When you're interested in something, it flies by. So that is our experience. So Buddhism would say that our experience of time is definitely subjective. But even at a more philosophical level, Buddhism would say that the very notion of time is a mind-made construct. It's somehow intrinsic in consciousness. So Kant said this in Western philosophy. He said that space and time were constructs that precede any experience. They're already intrinsically there in consciousness. We don't have to do anything, they're there. And it's because they're there that we have experience at all. Yeah? There's something mysterious going on that, from Kant's perspective, is to do with the mind. And Buddhism would say something similar. Yeah. So what I find interesting is physicists now asking things like, does time flow? Does it really flow from past to present to future? What is that flow, if there is a flow? What is it that's flowing, if there is a flowing? Because when you start thinking about, for different observers, what's happening now is different, depending on where they are in space. From a certain perspective in physics, it's better to think of all time as always being present. And it's the observer that's flowing. And for different observers, different things will appear as now. Really weird. So from a certain perspective, a model that physics uses is that all time is always somehow present. And what's moving is us, our mind, moving from one now to another now. And depending on where we are and how fast we're moving, my now won't be the same as another person's now. But somehow, everything was always present. Now that's a model. It's a model. I don't know what to make of that model, but it is a model that has some meaning in physics. Einstein, for example, he wrote to... I think a friend of his had died, and in a consolation letter that he wrote to the wife of a friend of his, he said something like, he has passed away a little ahead of me, and that means nothing. To those of us who believe in physics, past, present and future are nothing but a persistent illusion. That's quite something from Einstein, who overturned what our notions of time were. He's saying past, present and future are nothing but a persistent illusion. And the fact that his friend had died before he died, he said, in a way, that means nothing. So there's something mysterious there, isn't there? Again, from a Buddhist perspective... and again, I still don't know what I'm talking about, but enlightenment would be somehow stepping outside of this whole construct of space and time. It would be a perspective that wouldn't somehow be locked in space and time. Yeah? So the Buddha's body still was somewhere in space and time when he got enlightened. It was in northern India and 2,500 years ago, but his mind, the enlightened mind, wouldn't be confined to space and time in any particular way. So again, that's mysterious. His perception wouldn't be of being trapped in in space and time in this way.
It brings into question, from a physics point of view, what is time?
That's right, yeah.
And, I find that very difficult to get to, but recently Brian Cox did a programme about that.
Did he? Damn it.
And,
beat
and
me
said
to
that
it.
It's got something to do with entropy.
Ah, yes.
And he was also talking about the arrow of time.
The arrow of time. So that's a good point. Maybe I'll just touch on that. I may come back to it, but to touch on it now. Physicists have, as well as saying they're not sure what time is, and does it mean anything to say it's flowing, and does it mean anything to talk about past and present and future as if they absolutely existed, as well as questioning all of that, what they also say is, well, in experience, there does seem to be a direction to time. They call it the arrow of time. So in our ordinary everyday experience, there does seem to be a sense of past, present, future, or past and future. Present's more difficult to define, but there does seem to be some sort of arrow of time. And one way that they talk about that is that certain things that we observe seem to happen in one direction only. So eggs, once they're broken, if you break an egg and crack it open and say the egg white and the yolk fall on the floor, so you've just broken it onto the floor, the kitchen floor. Now, you never see the egg white and the yolk spontaneously moving, getting back into their shell, and the egg shell getting back together again, and the egg sitting back on the kitchen surface. You see it the other way round, the egg falling off the kitchen surface, and the egg white and the egg yolk spilling out. But you never see the thing in reverse, do you? If you were to play a film of that happening, you'd be able to tell that the reverse film was not real, because you never see that happening. But from a physics perspective, there's nothing to stop all the jiggling atoms in the egg white and the yolk to spontaneously decide to move and get together and go back into this eggshell, and for the eggshell to decide that it too wants to, decide's not the right word, but you know what I mean, to somehow come together again, and even the egg to decide that it wants to move from the floor to the kitchen surface. In quantum physics, particles can move sort of at random. So you could have all of these particles in this egg theoretically randomly decide to get together and form a whole egg from a broken egg. And the reason that you don't have that happen very often is because it's very, very, very unlikely that all of those particles would be able to move or decide to move in a coordinated way. They tend to move randomly. And there are billions and billions and billions of little particles in that egg, and they'd all have to move in a coordinated way for that egg to reform. Yeah? That's so unlikely that well, not only are you likely to win the lottery every day for the rest of your life, as being more likely, but you'd have to wait more than the age of the universe for, you'd have to keep watching that egg for more than the 14 billion years that we've had a universe for that to be likely to ever happen. Yeah, it's very, very, very unlikely. But physics says it's nevertheless possible. So one of the laws that Brian Cox was talking about is about how things tend to fall apart, but they tend not to spontaneously get together again. And that's because it's very unlikely. And that's one way of talking about the directionality of time, that in the future things will be more broken or more falling apart, And technically, what happens is, in the future, there'll be more entropy. If you didn't understand that, don't worry about it. That's a bit of an aside. Yes, go on.
If there's no difference between past and future, and we can't talk about now or simultaneity, then what does it mean to say that the universe is 14 trillion years?
Yeah, exactly. What does it mean to say anything, actually? What does it mean to say anything about anything? It's like physics has suddenly turned into philosophy. And it's not obvious what anything means. I guess all you could say is that to us sitting here, the universe seemed to have begun 14 billion years ago. But, I mean, that's a really weird thing to say anyway, isn't it? Because we're in the universe. Sorry, I'm going to move on, Roger, unless it's a question.
Well, it's just a point that Brian Cox pointed out, that actually the universe eventually, if you give it enough time, it does actually just completely decompose.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Becomes nothing at all.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, time
eventually
stops.
Yeah.
Because time can only be measured when there is something to measure it against.
Yeah.
When there is something happening.
Yeah.
And if nothing is happening.
Yeah.
Time.
So that's interesting, but it's only a theory. Actually, we don't quite know what will happen when we look to the billions and billions of years in the future. So one model is that everything will just dissolve and disappear and there'll just be nothing. Another model is that it's called the Big Crunch. That the universe will start to, instead of expanding, it will start to contract and get smaller and smaller and smaller, and gradually there'll, well not gradually, eventually there'll be a big crunch, just like there was a big bang. And there are other models as well. Yeah. But to come back to a notion of time, well, in a way, to come back to your point, it's even weirder, isn't it? Because with the Big Bang, time is said to have begun. It's not that the Big Bang happened in time. Time actually began with the Big Bang. So it's a bit weird to even think about the Big Bang. Because time, there wasn't a before.
Even the word begin kind of presupposes.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So we're really at the limit of what we can think about. One of the things I just want to say, though, is that Einstein's theory of relativity, he realised that you couldn't separate space from time, because the rate at which time flowed depended on motion through space. So what he said is that it's not that space and time are separate entities. Instead, there's this single entity called space-time. And that has four dimensions, three dimensions of space and one of time. And a better way of thinking about what's going on is that everything's happening in space-time. And you could see space-time in a way as, stretching out as a fabric in all directions, but also into the past and into the future. So we all exist as moments in space-time. You with me so far? So I'm going to move on to his general theory of relativity. So in his general theory of relativity, he started to talk about gravity. He started to talk about what was gravity was. And the general theory of relativity says that gravity is caused by matter in space-time. And what it is if you imagine space-time as a fabric, as a sheet, so space has three dimensions and time has, well, this one dimension. But if we reduce the dimensions, so you imagine just space-time as a flat sheet. And one good way of imagining it is imagine it, that flat sheet stretched out like it was a rubber sheet, like a trampoline. So imagine a trampoline, and you've got this flat trampoline. And then somebody very, very heavy stands on the trampoline. What happens is that that rubber sheet is curved by the weight of this heavy person. Yeah? And there's a definite dip in this sheet, and everything curves. But what Einstein is saying is that space-time itself becomes curved like that rubber sheet. But it gets curved by heavy things. Well, actually, it gets curved by all matter. But the heavier the matter, the more the curvature. So most things, you don't notice it curving space and time. But big things like planets and stars start to curve space-time more, in a more pronounced way. So our sun, which is massive, really, really massive, it's like putting a heavy object on the trampoline. So space-time has curved around our sun. It's curved into, it creates sort of valleys and peaks around this heavy object. And what happens is that our planet moves in that curved space-time, and because it's curved, our planet moves in a circle. It starts to orbit the sun because it's trying to move through curved space. If the space wasn't curved, the planet would just move in a straight line. But because the space is curved itself, when it tries to move in a space straight line, it winds out in a circle around this heavy dip. Yeah? A bit like sort of if you had that trampoline and then you had this heavy person in the middle and then you rolled a small ball, it would sort of curve towards that dip. Yeah? And fall into that dip probably. So Einstein's saying that gravity, what we think of as gravity, because we normally think of as the Earth revolving around the Sun because of the Sun's gravity, that gravity is really a curvature in space-time. And everything is moving in this curved space-time. So the Earth itself also has gravity, and the Moon is circulating the Earth, orbiting the Earth, because the Earth itself, as it moves, causes these ripples in space-time. And so what you've got from Newton saying that space-time was this static stage on which everything happened, with Einstein, you've now got space-time interacting with moving objects and somehow being alive to those moving objects, curving and uncurving, flowing and resolving itself as the objects move through it. Space-time is intrinsically bound up with the matter around it. Yeah? So that's really, really strange, because it's not... I mean, how do we imagine curved space when we've already got three dimensions? How, you'd have to have another dimension to curve into, wouldn't you? It's not possible to visualise this, or it's not very easy for us to visualise what curved space in our universe looks like. But that's what physicists say is happening, that gravity itself is this curved space-time. So that's a very, very different notion of space and time from what you had just a couple of hundred years ago. Yeah.
Does that... That must affect light as well.
Yeah.
But does it affect it differently from matter?
No, it affects light as well in the same way as matter. So if light was passing through space and you had this heavy object, you get the light bent by that heavy object. And they proved this, didn't they, by... there's a lovely, lovely experiment where they had stars that are normally... at a particular point, they would be behind the sun from Earth. So there's the Earth, there's the Sun, and then there's other stars in the night sky that would be directly behind the Sun. You normally wouldn't be able to see them because the sunlight would be obscuring them. But on a total eclipse of the Sun, you can suddenly see them. So there's a total eclipse of the Sun, there's darkness, and these stars appear. But the stars, they know from other observations, are directly behind the Sun. So you shouldn't be able to see them at all, even with a total eclipse. But what's happening is their starlight is being curved, bent round the Sun and reaching Earth in this curved pattern because it's been bent by the Sun's gravity. And another way of thinking about that is the space around the Sun is curved itself. So the light is following these curved patterns and reaches Earth. And they showed that that happened. So general relativity has a really, really high standing in the world of physics as being the most accurate theory of space and time that we've got to date. It's been proven to be really accurate. So we've got this weird notion now of not knowing quite what's going on. Space and time don't seem to obey common sense things. They change for observers, they depend on how fast you're moving, they seem to be curved and warped, time can slow down in gravity as well. So they're really quite mysterious things. But even that isn't the end of the story, because fundamentally we still don't know what space and time are. Yeah, physics doesn't know that. And one of the crunch points has come because on the one hand you've got quantum physics, quantum mechanics, which is really good at explaining how matter and energy behave. And then on the other hand, you've got general relativity, which is really good at saying how space and time behave. But the two theories are incompatible. When you try and combine the two theories, you get nonsensical results. So we know that they can't both be right. Do you see what I mean? There's these two really, really accurate theories of matter on the one hand, space and time on the other hand, and they can't be combined yet. There's no general agreement. So over the last 100 years or so, physicists have been trying to combine these two theories. Well, since the general theory of relativity, Einstein tried to combine these two theories. He and other physicists have thought that if you can combine them, that would explain everything. Yeah? It's the holy grail of physicists to combine these two huge edifices, these theoretical edifices. And they're still working on it. And one of the theories that is trying to combine them is string theory. Yes? Have you heard of string theory? So in string theory, little bits of matter are no longer just point-like particles. Instead, they're little wavy strings. They're little two-dimensional strings that can oscillate and vibrate. And string theory is an attempt to bring together relativity and quantum theory, quantum physics. But physicists have been working on it for over 30 years. Some of the most finest minds in science have been working on it. Well, hundreds of people have been working on it, and they haven't yet got very far. Well, they've got somewhere, but they don't seem to have cracked it. In fact, the more they look, the more mysterious it gets. And string theory at the moment is saying that we have not only three dimensions of space and one dimension of time forming this four-dimensional space-time, but string theory says in order for it to work, there are 10 dimensions of space out there and one of time. So we live in this 11-dimensional space-time world, but we're only aware of three of them, and time. And that's even weirder. Yeah? What's happened to the other dimensions, and where are they? Where are they? And string theory says that, well, one aspect of string theory says that they're very small, and they're, all these extra dimensions are hidden because they're very, very small. They're curled up, so small that we can't see them, but nevertheless they're there. And strings do see them, they move in all 11 dimensions. Yeah. So yeah, black holes are general relativity predicted them. So general relativity said, if you've got a very massive object, space-time becomes curved around it. If you've got an incredibly massive object, a black hole forms. What a black hole is it's a very, very, very big star that's collapsed on itself and become a very massive, small object. So it's you know, sort of hundreds of times or thousands of times as massive as our sun, but compressed into a space that's just, say, a few kilometres across. So that's really, really massive and dense. And what happens is that it's so massive and dense that space-time curves hugely around it. So it's like not just a little dip, but a big, vast, plummeting valley of space-time forms around this very massive object. And at the centre of that object, you've got infinite curvature. So space and time are infinitely curved, whatever that means. And space and time are so curved that light can't escape from the black hole. It just everything falls back in on itself because the black hole is so has caused such curvature. So you've got sort of infinite density in the middle of the black hole. Everything around it just gets sucked in, including the light around it from a certain distance gets sucked in. At the centre of the black hole, you've got this infinite density and infinite curvature of space and time. Who knows what that means? The equations of general relativity just break down because they can't handle what that means. When you move towards a black hole, hopefully you don't, but if you were to move towards a black hole, you'd move faster and faster because the gravity would be so strong. And as you moved faster and faster, time for you would slow down more and more. And somehow in the black hole itself, time would have stopped. Time would have stopped because you'd be, you know, space-time would have curved back on itself. So it's just the weirdest of things. General relativity predicted these weird things, and now they think they've found them. They think they've found them. They think there's a massive black hole in the centre of our galaxy, in the Milky Way. They think that that's what is at the centre, and everything's, the whole galaxy is whirling around this huge monster that's just gobbling up everything around it. So really weird things, yeah.
Can you give us a practical example of what would happen if we were to fall in one? If time doesn't exist, would we just exist forever in it?
Well, one of the things that would happen is called spaghettification. So, this is you, this pen, moving towards this black hole, and you're moving feet first. Because the gravity is so strong, your feet would feel more gravity than your head would, and that means you'd be stretched out, and you'd become this. Very, very quickly, you'll just become this incredibly long string. So you wouldn't actually be around to worry about time slowing down. You'd just be, everything would just be stretched out and you'd fall in. If you could survive that spaghettification, what would happen? I mean, time might stop for you. I don't know what that, again, what that means. And then it said that, you know, inside a black hole you might be able to, you know, find a way to another universe and things. Yeah. I mean, again, I don't know what that means. So people don't know.
Well, Flash Gordon managed it.
Flash Gordon managed it, and, they do say these things, yeah. I'll take one more, if it's a question and if it's about black holes.
Oh, it's not necessarily about black holes.
Go on then.
Well, the difficulty of marrying up quantum
yes.
theory and Einstein's relativity theory.
Yeah.
Is that demonstrated by the Schrödinger's cat idea?
No, I don't think it is. I think the Schrödinger's cat idea is just about quantum theory.
It's not about that paradox.
No. No, it's sort of different to that. I don't really understand how they don't marry up, but the maths doesn't marry up. And it's like general relativity breaks down in black holes, for example. It also breaks down when you start to think about the Big Bang. What happened at the start of the universe when you had all this infinite density of matter in a tiny, tiny spot? It's called a singularity, and general relativity can't handle that sort of extreme. It's infinitely dense and infinitely small. And quantum physics, of course, starts to come in when things get very small. So what you need is a theory that couples the very small with the very dense and things that affect space and time. And, you know, at the moment, general relativity is good at describing large-scale things like planets and stars and their movements in space and time. And quantum theory is really good at describing tiny, tiny bits of matter. But the two scales, when you try and marry them theoretically, you get nonsense out of the equations. And as I say, that's what other theories are trying to do. String theory, by the way, isn't the only one, and there are physicists who think that string theorists are barking up the wrong tree. There are other attempts at trying to bring these two things together. String theory's got a lot more popularity, as it were, and people have heard about it. But so I just want to, in a way, finish by just sort of trying to recap by saying we used to think, before Einstein, that space and time were just these blank stages on which the drama of the universe unfolded, and that they themselves didn't participate in that drama. They were just the canvas. Then Einstein came along and said space and time aren't so separate anyway, because time changes depending on how fast you are moving in space. You have to consider them together. And nor are they completely the same for all observers. Moving things will experience time differently and space differently to things that aren't moving. And because things move relative to each other, it causes these weird sort of seemingly paradoxical situations, time slowing down if you're moving or the rest of it. And then Einstein's general theory of relativity said that space-time itself interacts with matter and forms these weird valleys and mountain peaks and shapes in the universe that we experience as gravity. Yeah? So that gravity is actually just curved space-time. And then quantum theory, trying to reconcile that notion of gravity with what it knows of matter, is trying to come up with other theories, like string theory. And we haven't got an answer yet. We haven't got a theory that marries everything up. String theory is an attempt, and it's saying even weirder things, like we've got 11 dimensions of space-time. and that we're only able to experience three dimensions of space. It says even weirder things, like our whole universe might just be an entity moving in a larger dimensional space where there might be other universes that we're not in contact with. So, you know, it's got some really weird images to conjure up what's happening. But it's, at the moment, an incomplete theory, and it might be even proved wrong. You know, they don't know. So at the moment, we don't really know ultimately what space and time are from a physics perspective. We don't have much sense. All we know is that it's much, much weirder than we thought. Much, much weirder. And from a Dharmic perspective, and a Western idealist philosophical perspective like Kant, what they'd say is that space-time isn't something objective out there anyway. It's an aspect of consciousness. It's an aspect of consciousness. And that the enlightened mind somehow transcends space and time into this, in a way, this other way of being outside of it all. Yep. So that's a sort of brief whistle-top stop tour through relativity. I hope I've left you... Well, in a way, I don't want you to be clearer. I just want you to be positively baffled by what we think of in terms of space and time. And then next week, we'll try and... I want to try and sort of bring some of these strands together and contextualise them more from a Buddhist perspective. Good. Yeah.
So the one thing, the train carriage, was that just a thought experiment?
Yes, just a thought experiment.
So it wasn't actually...
No, because you can't move that fast for things to actually happen.
And if that's called the special theory of relativity.
That's called the special theory of relativity. That's true. Yeah, it's a special one. Good. Thank you very much, and hopefully see you next week.